come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The secret of the Georgia Guidestones has been solved. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. In a rural area of Georgia stands a granite monument, huge, nearly 20 feet tall. Several stones containing what some have called the Ten Commandments of the New Age or the Ten Commandments of the Illuminati, perhaps even the Ten Commandments of Lucifer. Our guest has embarked on an investigation, which has resulted in a new documentary film. He's the founder of Adullam Films and the writer and director of Dark Clouds Over Elberton, The True Story of the Georgia Guidestones. It's our honor to welcome Chris Pinto to the program. Chris, it's good to talk with you, brother.
Hey, Derek. Great to talk to you, too, brother. Good to be on your show again.
Well, it's been a while, and pleased to see you here in the beautiful Ozarks over the weekend. Unfortunately, didn't have time to sit down in the studio here, so I'm glad we could catch up by telephone to talk about this, because Sharon and I were blessed to watch a preview copy of Dark Clouds Over Elberton, and produced with you and our friend, by you and our friend Dr. Future, Dr. Michael Bennett, and we think you nailed it. The mystery of the identity of the man behind the Georgia Guidestones. R.C. Christian. But for people who aren't familiar, because the Georgia Guidestones, in terms of, popularity among conspiracy theorists, may not be as familiar to some folks as some others. It seems like we're always bumping into folks who've not heard of these stones before. What are the Georgia Guidestones, and what was it about them that drew your attention?
Well, the Georgia Guidestones were erected in 1980. When this mysterious stranger, the year prior in 1979, showed up in the small town of Elberton, Georgia, and he went to a granite company. Elberton is known as the granite capital of the world. And so they make all kinds of granite monuments. They make statues, memorials. They make a lot of tombstones and things like that. Anything having to do with granite, that's what they're known for. And they have a long history of the granite industry. That's been the backbone of that town. Of course, it's been declining in, you know, recent decades. But this mysterious stranger, a well-dressed man, showed up, and he walked into a local granite company there where they had granite quarries and this kind of thing. And he sat down, he introduced himself as R.C. Christian and admitted that this was not his real name, that it was a pseudonym that he had chosen, and that he wanted to have this large granite monument erected. And he wanted them to build it. Now, exactly where it was going to be located, he had a number of different locations, but he knew he wanted the work done there in Elberton because of their expertise in granite quarrying and finishing and so on. But he wouldn't give his real name at first and said he wanted to keep that a secret. Well, the man he spoke to was a guy named Joe Fenley, who was the owner of this granite company. And Mr. Fenley wasn't sure whether or not he could believe what this man was telling him. And he didn't know what this monument was going to be about. But then once the man gave him the dimensions and told him that he wanted this thing to be nearly 20 feet tall, and there was going to be all these large blocks of stone, he realized this was going to be a very expensive job, very lucrative for him. But because the guy was giving a false name, he didn't know whether or not he could believe him.
Exactly. Show me the money. Yeah.
Yeah. So what he did was he said, okay, well, if you're serious about this, then we're going to need to come up with some way to handle the financing. So he said, I want you to go to the stranger had said, you know, where do you bank? And he told him, you know, told him the name of the Elberton Bank there, and sent him over to see a friend of his named Wyatt Martin. And his thought was, well, if he can prove to Wyatt Martin, who was the bank president, that he is financially able to afford a project like this one, then we'll move forward, you know. But he still wasn't sure whether or not he could trust the guy. And so the man got up and walked out of the office, went over to the Elberton Bank and met with Wyatt Martin, who was the president of the bank, and sat down with him, and told Mr. Martin what he wanted to do and that he wanted somebody to handle the finances, to be the financial mediator for this project. And so Wyatt Martin talked to him for a while, and he said, okay, but I can't open it. He says, we're going to need to open a bank account, but we can't open a bank account under a false name. So I have to know who you are. And so that's when Mr. Christian, as they called him, Mr. Christian, said, okay, I'll tell you my true identity, but you've got to give me your word that you won't reveal who I am to anyone. And so Wyatt Martin agreed. And this is why Wyatt Martin, if you study the Georgia Guidestones, and there's been a number of histories that have been done of it, he's the one man who has always known the true identity of R.C. Christian. And he had, you know, vowed or given his word that he would take that secret to his grave and never tell anyone the identity of the stranger. So then the story goes on from there, and then, you know, Wyatt Martin handled the financing. Joe Fenley did the building for it and so on. And then the whole town was, well, maybe not the whole town, but a number of leaders in the town were involved with the erection of the monument because they wanted it for the promotion of the granite industry and to promote the small town of Elberton, to encourage tourism and people coming there and so on. But unfortunately, they did not really know what this monument was going to be about. They had no idea what the real philosophies were behind the Georgia Guidestones, as they were called. And so when these things were finally erected in 1980 and they were unveiled, you know, we show some of the original news footage with them pulling the, you know, the canvas off the monument and unveiling this thing to the world. And then people began to read what was written on the stones. You know, they sometimes call them the Ten Commandments of the New Age or the Ten Commandments of the Antichrist, but it's communicating. You know, the first command says to maintain a world population below 500 million people.
That would be a little problematic.
Yeah, because right now we've got 7 billion people in the world, approximately. Back then, there was a little bit more than 5 billion. But in any case, a lot of people would have to die.
Yeah, 9 out of 10.
Would have to disappear or somehow or other stop living on the Earth in order to make that number a reality.
Well, that's just a little disturbing.
Well, and that's been the thing, Derek, about the monument for more than 30 years now that has troubled most everybody that, you know, has come in contact with it, has asked that same question. What is it that he's trying to communicate? When we interviewed Wyatt Martin, he said that that's probably the number one thing. You know, people would call him and say, well, what's he suggesting? Is he talking about killing everybody else in the world? That's what he said literally when we interviewed him. But his impression of Mr. Christian, R.C. Christian, was that that wasn't necessarily what he intended. According to Wyatt Martin, that the monument was erected during the time of the Cold War, during the Cold War era. And Wyatt Martin's impression of it was that the monument was designed because it's got these astronomical indicators there. You know, there's the a slot cut in the center stone so that you can view the horizon and so on. And then there's a hole cut in the center stones facing the northernmost star, Polaris, et cetera, so that you could reestablish the calendar. There's supposed to be a sundial on one side, but apparently they didn't complete it, at least based upon, you know, the monument as it stands today. But the full design of the monument was never fully complete because there were the initial stones that were designed, and then there was supposed to be an outer ring of stones. But apparently they ran out of money while they were building the monument.
Just one more way in which the ancients were far superior to mankind. I mean, you know, 2500 BC, the Bronze Age Britons were able to put together Stonehenge, and here in 1980 in America, we can only put up four because we can't afford the freight.
Right. Well, that was the thing is, you know, this is where you, well, the story for me got very interesting because when you are, you have all these theories about who R.C. Christian was, and many people seem to think that he was some multi-millionaire, billionaire type figure like Ted Turner, mm-hmm. or maybe L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology and this kind of thing. But in looking at what actually happened with the monument, you realize that the people who were involved did not have unlimited resources, that they themselves had boundaries and limitations. That was one thing for me when we were investigating this that I found very interesting, that they had wanted to have this outer ring of stones, but then they ran out of money. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange based upon what we've always been told or led to believe about the builder of these stones.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, as we reveal by the end of the film, once we find out who R.C. Christian really was, we realize that while he was a prominent citizen in his community, he was well-to-do, certainly, but he wasn't somebody who had unlimited resources. He wasn't a multi-billionaire or somebody like that, which I found to be very interesting by the time we got to the end of this, really, this detective story as it unfolded.
And in the interest of full disclosure, I will tell listeners right now that we are not going to tell you who R.C. Christian is during this program. I think it's only fair to Chris and Mike and the work that they put into Dark Clouds Over Elberton that you get a copy of the DVD for a couple of reasons. Number one, respect the fact that they put a lot of effort and personal expense into it. But secondly, this is the thing that I really appreciate about the film. It's interesting having this mystery resolved, but it's also important that it was resolved by Christians. And so that the proper worldview is filtering the message of this monument. And we'll touch on that a little bit later in the program, but a little bit more on the actual process of discovering who R.C. Christian actually was, Chris. What sort of reaction did you get from Wyatt Martin and the other folks in Elberton when you went down there and told them what you were doing?
Well, they were pretty receptive. Of course, they've done a lot of interviews. They've been interviewed by authors and reporters and documentarians and the History Channel and CNN. I mean, a lot of people have done stories on the Georgia Guidestones for more than 30 years now. So this was, Wyatt Martin was even a little bit reluctant to meet with us at first, simply because he'd done so many interviews and he was kind of, you know, what he's used to seeing from what he told us is people speculating about who they think R.C. Christian was. And he says he hears some of these stories out there. And of course, he knows that the vast majority of the speculations are simply not true, not just about R.C. Christian, but about what the monument symbolizes and what it was intended to symbolize. And so we told him our approach to this thing was to do really a step-by-step history of the monument and to explore exactly what happened, talk to the people who were involved directly as much as we could, and especially to focus on people who interacted with R.C. Christian. And there was Wyatt Martin, of course. Joe Fendley, unfortunately, had passed away in 2005, so we could not interview him. But we did get a chance to interview his son, Joe Fendley Jr., who appears on camera in the film. And he actually tells a really interesting story at one point about a phone call that had happened years ago, after the year 2000, but he couldn't say the exact year. But it was after the year 2000, he said that his father, Joe Fenley Sr., got a phone call one night from R.C. Christian.
Huh.
And R.C. Christian called him at home, and he said, "I'm ready to reveal myself. I want the world to know who I am." And Joe Fenley said to him, He said, well, I haven't known who you are all these years, and I don't want to know.
Hmm.
And so Joe Fenley said, apparently, this is according to his son now, Joe Fenley Jr., that R.C. Christian wanted to reveal his identity, but Joe Fenley didn't want it to happen. And apparently, they like the idea of a mystery being there because it compels people to come and see the monument and then come up with theories and, you know, try and speculate who this guy was. And it's sort of, it's almost like chasing a carrot on a stick. You never actually get to the carrot, but it keeps you moving forward.
Right, right.
And that's, they like that mystique. They like that aspect of the mystery. So I'm not sure how they're going to feel about the fact that, you know, that we've uncovered who he was.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it that you and Michael Bennett were able to discover that these previous investigators and journalists weren't?
Well, what we were able to do was to get, it was our interview with Wyatt Martin, as you saw in the film. When we interviewed Mr. Martin, we had read in a Wired magazine article a story about Wyatt Martin and how he had revealed that he kept all of his paperwork from his correspondence with R.C. Christian in an old IBM computer case, and that he had stored this case out in his garage. And so we knew that before we met with him. When we met with him, we asked him about this case and was it true that he really had his, you know, his paperwork in this old IBM computer case. And he said yes. And there had been some speculation about him destroying the paperwork, but he said he had not done that because he was thinking about writing a book on his experience with the Guidestones.
Huh.
So he had kept the paperwork. So we asked him if we could see the IBM computer case. And at first he said no, but then later on he agreed to show it to us. And so took us out, you know, and we show you in the film, you see him walking us out the back door and going out really to the shed in the backyard and pulling out, or he had Mike actually pull out his old IBM computer case. And, you know, he actually had us open it up at one point and read some letters from R.C. Christian and talked about some of the correspondence and whatnot. But through all of that, that's where we found certain clues, which you see in the film. But we found certain clues that he didn't actually reveal who R.C. Christian was, but there were certain clues in the paperwork that we were able to go and track down after our interview with him, and that's how we ultimately discovered the identity of R.C. Christian.
One of the most entertaining aspects of the film, especially because we know you and we know Dr. Future, Michael Bennett, is watching the gentle way in which he keeps rephrasing the question to Mr. Martin. It's like, well, you know, do you think we might be able to see that case? Well, do you think we could pull it out and just take a look at it? Well, now that we got it out, do you think we could just open it and take a look? Well, you know, this is the last chance to really do this and get this all, you know, and the way Mr. Martin just gradually warms to the idea of actually opening it and showing you some of the documents. Now, do you think, given that this gentleman was a bank president, he certainly was not, he's certainly an intelligent man. Knowing that you were standing there with a camera in your hands, Chris, do you suspect that maybe this was his way of perhaps letting things out while still remaining true to his promise to Mr. Christian to take his secret with him to the grave?
You know, I kind of go back and forth on that. There may be something to what you're saying, Derek, although I don't know. Where he's concerned, where R.C. Christian is concerned, I think it's very likely that he wanted to reveal himself, as Joe Fenley Jr. said. But where Mr. Martin is concerned, I don't know.
Hmm.
I think because in the case, we don't actually see anything that has the name of R.C. Christian on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mr. Martin knew that. And at one point he says, even if they got the case, they still wouldn't know who R.C. Christian was. Because he's talking about how, you know, somebody might come looking for that case or something. And so I can only wonder what Mr. Martin would think about it. But maybe he did want, you know, the mystery to go a step further. We had part of our investigation was, you know, one with Wyatt Martin. Obviously, we got a lot of great information through him. But then we also went to Coggins Industries. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Frank Coggins, who's now deceased, but we were actually able to interview him before he passed away. And you see his interview in the film. But he's probably the leading promoter in the town of Elberton, of the town itself, and he was involved in the promotion of the Guidestones when they were being built. But we were given from Coggins Industries and the current president, Mrs. Shirley McNeely, very, very nice lady, who gave us a whole stack of paperwork with all kinds of details in it. We had unique drawings, writings and handwritten letters and notes and so on from R.C. Christian, his handwritten drawings of the Guidestones and things, and measuring them out and so on, talking about how he wanted things laid out on the property where they ultimately ended up putting them. And so there we found a lot of detailed information that I've never seen published anywhere else on the Guidestones themselves. And one of them, as we talked about before, when I was there interviewing with you guys, the letter that makes a connection to the Rosicrucian Society.
That was where, that was intriguing.
Yeah, it really, really was, because a lot of people have speculated about the name R.C. Christian, which has such an association with the Rosicrucians. And then here we found in the stack of paperwork, and it was kind of detached from everything else. But there, and we show it to you in the film, it starts out with the words, "To whomever comes upon this presenting." And it says, "Contained herein are keys," and it goes on from there. And it appears to be a message that would have been included inside the time capsule that is said to have been buried next to the monument. And the reason I say that, there's that flat slab of stone that's next to the Georgia Guidestones, and on that it has the description, R.C. Christian, a pseudonym, and so on. And then it says a time capsule placed here on, but then it doesn't give a date. And so there's been speculation for years about whether or not they actually buried a time capsule there. Mm-hmm. And when we interviewed Mr. Martin, Wyatt Martin says that there was no time capsule buried there. Then we interviewed Wayne Mullinex, and Wayne Mullinex actually laid the foundation for the monument.
So he would know.
So, yeah, he would be the one guy who would know whether or not they actually put a time capsule down below. But he would not say one way or the other. And you see that on camera in the film, our conversation, and Mike Bennett's trying to get Mr. Mullinex to tell us whether or not there's a time capsule there, and he wouldn't say one way or the other.
He was a little less cooperative than Mr. Martin.
Right. Very nice man. Very, very nice man. I have to say, all the people who we talked to were very, very nice, very helpful, and encouraging about a documentary on the Guidestones. But then we interviewed Mart Clamp. His father was Charlie Clamp, who sandblasted the letters into the Guidestones. And if you go and read about that, Charlie Clamp supposedly claimed that he heard strange music and disjointed voices while he was sandblasting the letters into the monument.
Huh.
You read that all over the place. Now, we asked Mark Clamp about that, his son, whether or not that was true, and he just kind of laughed it off and said, "No, not really," and then he kind of went on from there. But we could never find out where that story came from, and unfortunately, we were not able to talk to Charlie Clamp. But when we talked to Mark Clamp about the time capsule, he suggested that maybe they really did bury the time capsule there, but then did not want to put a date because they didn't want anybody to come out and actually try to pick it up.
Hmm. So the flat slab, just to be clear for listeners, the flat slab that covers the area where the time capsule is supposedly buried, The dates of the burial of the time capsule and the date when it's supposed to be opened were left blank. There is nothing carved in the stones in those spots.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then we find in the paperwork from Shirley McNeely and Coggins Industries, we find the letter or the message that suggests that there are keys placed inside of something. And in that letter, it goes on to describe the association between the name R.C. Christian and the name Christian Rosenkrantz, who is the mythical founder of the Rosicrucians from the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes a direct association between the name R.C. Christian and Rosicrucianism, and then goes on to say that whoever comes upon these keys is to then hand the keys over to the Overton Star, which is a newspaper, and then the Overton Star is to hand them over to the Atlanta Rosicrucian Society. So the message that we found, the letter that we found, gives a very definite connection to Rosicrucianism. Now, where it goes from there, we were not able to discover. We did contact the Atlanta Rosicrucians, and while they claimed to have some knowledge about this, they wouldn't talk about it on camera, and they would not give too many details.
Huh.
But of course, the Rosicrucians are known as the most secret of the secret societies.
Hmm.
We also contacted the Elberton Star, but they said that they kind of laughed and chuckled about it, and they said they'd never been given any keys. So they don't know what it's about.
That's really that's really curious.
Yeah. But it's just one of the mysterious pieces of the puzzle to the story of the Guidestones. But people have speculated about a Rosicrucian connection, and was R.C. Christian a Rosicrucian? I think there's a significant amount of evidence to show that there's a definite connection, but it's hard to get details beyond that.
Mm. Now, again, without divulging any specifics about the actual identity of R.C. Christian, which you do reveal in the film, and again, that's the reason we're withholding that during this program, what did you learn about his background, his beliefs, and how that might have informed or influenced the message that's placed on the Georgia Guidestones?
Well, the Guidestones monument itself is very much an environmental monument. It's talking about population control, maintaining the world population below 500 million. Then the next command or guide, as they're called, talks about a guiding reproduction wisely, which fits in with the philosophies of the man who was behind the name R.C. Christian, because we ultimately track him down to his hometown, which is a small town in the Midwest, where he was a prominent citizen there, and met with a couple of local historians who knew him in life. And he's since passed away, but we actually go out to his gravestone, his tombstone, and on his tombstone there are clues for how he wanted to be remembered. But it points in the direction of his ideology as an environmentalist and his, his kind of new age environmental beliefs.
Guiding reproduction wisely, is that just a reference to controlling population? And of course, the Guidestones would suggest they want to do so with extreme prejudice. Or is there something more to that particular phrase? Is it a euphemism for something else?
No, there's definitely something more to it, because one of the local historians claims on camera that R.C. Christian was friends with Dr. William Shockley. Mm. Dr. Shockley, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning scientist who invented the transistor and is considered the founder of Silicon Valley and so on, a very famous scientist from the 20th century, but who was known for his beliefs about race and his views that blacks were racially inferior to whites, and he would make that very plain.
Hmm.
But he talked about a guiding reproduction, okay, and talked about how he believed people who had an IQ of less than 100 should be paid money to be sterilized so that they would not reproduce. That's just an example of, you know, Shockley's suggestion about reproduction. And so once you realize that connection is there, and then you see guide reproduction wisely on the guidestones, it becomes very disturbing. Not only that, but then there's the book that was published some 5 years after the monument was built. And this plays a very important part in uncovering the clues about who R.C. Christian was, because we contacted the book publisher, found out who published the book, and so on. But in the book that was published, it's called Common Sense Renewed, and was written by the author of the Guidestones. And there, he, in no uncertain way, is talking about global government, talking about government control of the world population, talking about things like what they do in China with requiring people to maintain a one-child family, with punishments for people who go beyond having just one child, just like they do in China where they have forced abortions and things like that. Mm-hmm. Now, he doesn't come out in his book and actually use terms like forced abortion. And he never talks about things like concentration camps or anything like that. But he's most definitely talking about government intervention into controlling the world population.
Eugenics.
Eugenics. And you're left wondering, well, how is this going to be carried out? You know, there's got to be. And when you look at the history of what has happened with Hitler and Nazism and the Holocaust, et cetera, the implications are very sinister and very disturbing.
Yeah, it's uses terminology that would test better for focus groups than eugenics and forced sterilization. In the same way that the eugenics movement has resurrected itself under the transhumanist movement banner, or and as a woman's right to choose. As we look at statistics from New York City, for 2013, more than half of the unborn black children in New York City were terminated, were killed, were aborted. So it's, if you can sell it that way, then you don't need the government to impose it, because people are because it's their constitutional right to choose. And it is astonishing that we've been induced to follow this program, that if it were imposed on us, we would absolutely rebel against.
Right. And look at what's happening, Derek. We've got all of these scandals with Planned Parenthood and then selling body parts and this kind of thing on the black market. It is, and a lot of this, I think the reason there's not more of an outcry from the left, from the left wing of American politics in our country, is because they are influenced by these politicized environmental ideas. Mm-hmm. And they think that having a lower world population is just better for the planet. Mm. And, of course, I think you and I would both agree that taking care of the environment is a good thing. It's nothing that Christian people are against. We don't want pollution. We don't want smoke in the air and all
That's
this
right.
kind of thing. But politicized environmentalism that says that somehow or other animals and trees are more important than human beings.
Right.
That's where it becomes very disturbing. And unfortunately, this all goes back to the Nazi philosophy. The mm-hmm. Nazis were environmentalists. They were animal rights activists. But they didn't care much for human beings,
people
that they saw as being genetically inferior.
Exactly right. Yes. I did an interview recently with Mark Musser, author of the book Nazi Oaks, in which he documents the links between the radical environmental movement and the Nazi Party, which was, after all, a cult and not really a political movement. Speaking of veneration of the creation instead of the creator, Chris, how have other belief systems, say, you know, Wiccans, pagans, and so forth, what has been their reaction to the Georgia Guidestones?
Well, that was one of the interesting things about interviewing Mr. Martin. We at first tended to shy away from drawing attention to the witches and that kind of thing, because we weren't sure how willing they would be to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the people involved with the monument went to that issue. In fact, Wyatt Martin, we interviewed him for like 3 hours, talked about all kinds of things. And then at the end of the interview, I said, well, Mr. Martin, is there anything you wanted to talk about? And he said, well, you know, the one thing you haven't yet asked me about is the involvement of the witches who came at one point and tried to take over the monument. And he said that there was initially back in the 1980s and 90s, I guess, there was a whole movement of witches who were very involved with the monument, and they would have weddings up there and ceremonies and do all kinds of things. And they see, you know, people would drive by late at night and they would see candles and lanterns and things like that, that were lit up. And so all kinds of strange rituals that were going on. So yeah, the witches were very involved. Wyatt Martin said he used to get letters from people who were involved in witchcraft talking about the symbolism of the monument. Kind of a funny story, when we were filming up there, in the film we show some dramatizations of you know, like a witch wearing a black robe and a hood and carrying a lantern around the monument. And we were up there filming probably about 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and it was dark. And we're filming, and I had my actor walking around carrying a lantern and walking in between the stones and this kind of thing. He's wearing this black cloak, you know, with a hood pulled down over his face. And after a few minutes, a police car pulled up, and the sheriff's deputy showed up because they had surveillance cameras there at the monument. And so he got out, and he was shaking his head, and he was kind of laughing. And he walked over, and he could see me there with a camera. So he walked over, and he said, well, we got a call, and somebody said the Grim Reaper was here at the monument. So
as if local law enforcement would have any jurisdiction over the Grim Reaper.
Yeah. But you know the reason they have those security cameras up there is because the monument was, well, back in the 1980s and 90s, it was, you know, people knew about it, I guess, but there wasn't it wasn't until the internet went up in the 1990s and people started getting online and studying prophecy and studying globalism and the New World Order and global government and all this other kind of stuff, that the Guidestones started getting more and more attention. And then people got very angry at them there for a while. And so people would go to the monument and they would spray paint, you know, death to the New World Order and things like this on the monument itself. So the people of the town, that's when they put the security cameras up there to try and monitor whatever was going on and to keep people from going and, you know, vandalizing the monument. But yeah, now they have a whole security system, but now they've gotten rid of all the spray paint and all that other kind of stuff. We went there twice filming, and the first time we went, you see in the film where somebody had splashed epoxy, some type of epoxy on the stones that left this just terrible stains on different parts of it, and people have written on it and spray painted it and all this other kind of stuff. And then we went back like a year later, or however long it was, and they had cleaned it up by then. So apparently the security cameras are working. People get, they're very, you know, some people are very, you know, we interviewed a local pastor there, and he appears in the film, and he talked about how people fall into two main categories with it. Some people think it's just a tourist attraction, he said, and they think it's kind of amusing. But then other people get very disturbed by it, and they think it's the work of the devil, and they're very offended by the message that is carved in stone there. And they get very emotional, and they get very upset. And I think that continues even to this day, even though the vandalism has been somewhat dealt with. But I think people are still, you know, just upset. They have a sense of indignation at the arrogance of people who think that we need to get rid of a certain portion of the population that is undesirable.
Yeah. And it's always other people. It's never the guys who are promoting the idea that we need to cull the herd who are volunteering to be first in line.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's always somebody else that needs to go.
Uh-huh.
But we, you know, one of the things that we try to really bring out in the film is we bring the whole thing full circle. Is one of the things carved in the stones is a message that says, "Let these be guidestones to an age of reason." And the reference seems pretty clearly to be to the book by Thomas Paine, who wrote the book The Age of Reason, in which he's calling for the abolishment of Christianity and the abolishment of organized religion. And one of the things that we talk about in the film is the fact that it's Christianity that inspires us to look with compassion and with mercy and with love toward people who would ordinarily be considered undesirable, that this is how the love of God works. The Bible says God has chosen the poor of this world for salvation. At one point, Paul says, "You see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty men, not many noble are called, for God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and weak things to shame them that are strong. And things which are base, things which are despised, God has chosen, and the things which are not to bring to nothing the things that are," and so on. So Christianity reaches out to those who are downtrodden, to those who are weak, to those who would be considered genetically inferior, quite frankly, by the global elitists who want to diminish the world population. And I think that's the... that's the part of the monument that to me was most disturbing, is that the implication seemed to be to get rid of the Bible-based Christian worldview about the love of God reaching out to our fellow man and trying to lift them up and bring them to salvation, but rather, instead of that, to take a very cold-hearted clinical view of science and humanity and so on, and really to treat human beings even worse than the way we treat animals. I mean, if you treat an animal the way that Planned Parenthood is treating these aborted fetuses and aborted children, really, I mean, there would be such an outcry. It would be seen as inhumane,
right?
You know, to treat animals this way. And yet, unfortunately, there's a philosophy that allows people to treat human beings that way.
Yeah, and supposedly that is enlightened thought. Chris, the film is extremely well done. Again, Sharon and I really appreciate the opportunity to have viewed it, and we are glad to do whatever we can to let people know about it, because, again, the information that you bring out is nothing that we have seen. There are things that you and Mike bring out in the film that we have not seen anywhere else before. And we've done a fair bit of reading about the Georgia Guidestones. And especially, of course, the key, the identity of the mysterious R.C. Christian. And then beyond that, elaborating a bit based on people who knew him, what his worldview was and how that led to the Guidestones. Now, I guess the other question is, you know, did he do this all by himself or were there others involved in this? Did you get any information about that?
Well, certainly, he says he said openly at the time, and it's actually written on the monument, that he represented a small group of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So he clearly, from the beginning, stated that he was not alone. Mm-hmm. We tracked down at least one other person who worked with him, and we show who that person was
right.
in the film. Also, we actually went and interviewed a family member of. We interviewed people who knew R.C. Christian. And then people who also knew, or a relative who knew the man who worked with him, and then we had to, of course, had to make the connection between the two men and prove that those two men knew each other in life, because the information is kind of, you know, it's separated initially, but then we had to bring it together and make sure that these guys had a relationship with each other. But apparently they did, and the local historians there in their hometown acknowledge that, yes, these men did, in fact, know each other. And a family member that we interviewed, when we told him about what we had uncovered, he said, you know, if you knew my uncle, said, if you knew my uncle, really hearing this information, it's not a big surprise. Not a big surprise. He said it based on what we were sharing with him, that it fit in with the character of, you know, who he knew his uncle to be. So it was, yeah, there's a lot of very powerful and unique information that we bring out.
So it's well worth adding to your reference collection, Dark Clouds Over Elberton, The True Story of the Georgia Guidestones, the new DVD from Adullam Films. The website is adullamfilms.com. Chris Pinto, the founder, writer, and director of the film, thanks for taking up, let me take up some of your time today, brother, and we look forward to talking with you again.
All right, Derek. Thanks so much. God bless you.
See the show notes at vftb.net for a link to Adullam Films. I'm also going to put a link to where you can get a copy of Dark Clouds Over Elberton, because Tom Horn for Skywatch TV is offering a special deal. I'm actually going to put the link to the Skywatch TV store, because folks now who purchase a copy of Dark Clouds Over Elberton at the list price of $24.95 plus shipping and handling from the Skywatch TV store, Tom Horn is tossing in, while supplies last, a copy of the Mark Flynn book, Forbidden Secrets of the Labyrinth, which is an excellent book and normally retails for $19.95 itself. So you're getting as a $20 value that add-in at no charge, and it relates to the same topic, some of the occult influences on our modern society. The Guidestones, and in fact, I didn't even ask Chris about this. I'm going to have to do this at some point, because Sharon and I noticed this while we watched the video, that when you look at the overhead depiction of the Guidestones, the way in which the four big granite slabs are arranged is in the form of a reverse swastika. I mean, it's pretty clear to my eye. Now, maybe I'm just seeing things that weren't intended, but it seems to me that it's pretty obvious. So, and, you know, who knows? Maybe Mr. Christian intended for the design to represent that, and maybe it was just a, well, maybe he was guided without his knowledge even. But it is a it gives a well, I think it kind of confirms the interpretation that we as Christians have of the Georgia Guidestones, that they are clearly representing a globalist agenda and a globalist one world government agenda, especially one that wants to eliminate more than 90% of the world population, is nothing if not Luciferian in the worst sense of the word. Because those who promote this idea that the world is overpopulated by 90% or more, like Pope Francis' science advisor, John Schnellenhuber, the guy who advised the Pope on his climate change encyclical that was released earlier this year, is one of these guys who believes that we need to eliminate 6 billion or more humans in order to maintain a balance between the human population and nature. And as Josh Tolley discussed on an earlier View from the Bunker program, the population of the world is actually peaking. It is peaking and will begin to decline before we get into the second half of the 21st century. It's going to peak at about 9 billion and then begin to decline. Back in 1980, when the Georgia Guidestones were erected, the world's population was 5 billion. And as they disclose in Dark Clouds Over Elberton, R.C. Christian and those who thought like him were convinced that the world was going to be at 10 billion people by now, by the year 2000, or shortly thereafter. We're not there yet, because birth rates are declining, in the Northern Hemisphere especially. Birth rates are declining. We are not having enough children to even maintain current population. And as we in the, I'm at the tail end of the baby boom. I'm 53 right now, and I'm at the tail end of the baby boom. As the baby boom begins to age out out of the population statistics, the population is going to begin to decline starting in about 2050. That leads to some really interesting geopolitical situations in which the military planners who are looking at these numbers and who are not stupid are realizing that there's just a small window of opportunity for them to do what they think they want to do or got to do before they don't have enough men to do it. This could also be why certain nations like Germany, which now says it's going to take not just 800,000, I think I said 80,000 on the last program, 800,000. They're now saying they're going to take 1 million Middle Eastern refugees. And it could be why we here in the United States have allowed in, depending on who you ask, anywhere from 11 to 20 million illegal immigrants from south of the border. It's to maintain the population of the country. Because we don't have the tax base, if we don't have the population, to support the aging population that is increasingly dependent on government handouts. My mother, God love her, benefits from Social Security and Medicare Part whatever for her medications and prescriptions. And as I, get older, I will soon be availing myself of those things, assuming that they're still around in another dozen years or so. But as more and more of us start drawing off the government teat, the government coffers, and there are fewer and fewer people of prime working age who are contributing tax revenue, we become in the situation becomes increasingly untenable. And again, it's not just here, but it's in Europe as well. And I don't for a moment believe that the people in government, in Washington, in Brussels, London, wherever, are really so stupid that they don't see this coming in Russia. Certainly not in Russia, because we've been joking for the last 10 years or so. Every year it seems that we see a story as a kicker, one of those little weird or wacky stories to close out a newscast about the Russians offering financial incentives for people to take a day off of work, go home, and make babies because they understand the situation. They're running out of people. Japan is an increasingly aging population. Not enough young people to replace the population. Not enough young people to support the aging population. And the other shoe of Obamacare and health systems like it, nationalized health care systems like it, that when you become you get to a certain age where the cost of preserving or extending your life is longer than it feels, when the cost benefit analysis is no longer in your favor, then benefits are withdrawn. It's easier to just it's less expensive on the state for you to just die than to receive the benefits that had been promised to extend your life. And I think that's ultimately where this sort of mindset, this worldview that is blasted into the granite of the Georgia Guidestones leads. Ultimately, that's where it leads. Soylent Green is people. You're too old for your life to have any worth to the state. So just do us a favor, nip off and do yourself in. Is it a coincidence that we are now seeing through, with the assistance of major media, the push for assisted suicide here in the United States? It's already legal in Europe. It's legal in Canada now. It's legal in some states here in the United States. And it's being sold to us, as we discussed last year, when the tragic case of Brittany Maynard was all over the news. She presented a very appealing, a very emotional case in favor of assisted suicide. Attractive young woman suffering a tragic, fatal brain tumor that claimed her life. And because we're living in a postmodern society where words, facts, doctrines have no meaning anymore. Emotions are all that matter. Displaying her image and presenting her in a video with soft, emotionally evocative music in the background makes a more powerful case for assisted suicide and compelling doctors to participate in assisted suicide. It's very effective. As I, again, I don't think it's coincidence that this is coming at the same time that we're seeing the population curve, the bulge in the population curve, aging to the point where we seniors will soon be considered a burden on a shrinking number of youth, because there just won't be enough of them paying taxes to provide the social benefits that we had been promised by the state, that we voted for ourselves. And of course, as they can continue to beat the drum that climate change is the result of human activity, and specifically because there are just too darn many of us, well, then they can make the case that we need to be culled from the herd in the interest of preserving humanity long term and saving Mother Earth. We'll talk about this mindset further in a program that will be uploaded Sunday, the 16th. Is that the 16th? No, that can't be right, because the 16th is when you're hearing this. Rather, that would be the 20th. September the 20th, you will hear an interview with science fiction author John C. Wright. He's written a couple of books that I found very engaging, entertaining, thought-provoking. His anthology of essays called Science, Transhuman and Subhuman, Science Fiction and Awful Truth. He's found himself in the very unique position of setting the record for most nominations for a Hugo Award in a single year. The Hugo Awards were one of the two major awards handed out to science fiction authors, along with the Nebula. He was nominated for 6 this year at the Hugo Awards, and one of them was withdrawn. One of his works was disqualified because it was actually published to the internet a few days before the qualification period. So, okay. They followed the letter of the law. With 5 nominations at the Hugo Awards ceremony, in every single category, in all 5 of the categories for where John Wright was nominated, the award went to no award. Why? Because John C. Wright is a very outspoken Christian who believes that the Bible is true, who believes in the gender roles assigned to male and female, created he them male and female at the beginning. And apparently in 21st century, the science fiction genre, that's bad think. You're not supposed to think that way, believe that way. That is regressive thought. And so he was punished by the voters for the Hugos this year, and no award handed out in all 5 of the categories for which John C. Wright was nominated. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about what turned him from a hardcore atheist who believed that faith in Christ was as silly as faith in Santa Claus. Well, maybe not silly, but well, yeah, that was how he would have described it. Let's say as baseless as faith in Santa Claus. What was it that converted him now into one who was absolutely sure that God exists and that the only path to the Father is through Jesus Christ? That interview, fascinating. We talked yesterday afternoon. Amusing in that you'll hear the lawnmower, our yard tractor in the background passing by the window at a pretty regular interval. This is the one that we had to get to replace the one that melted, that went up in flames a few weeks ago. But if you can tolerate that auditory interruption, I think you'll really appreciate the interview. That coming up Sunday. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, also on Sunday, earlier in the day, typically posted by late morning. We're running through the book of Deuteronomy, and as we are discovering, for me especially, week after week, that even in these sections of the Bible that I always thought were a bit tedious when I was reading through the scriptures alone, there's a lot of stuff in there, and it's actually a lot more interesting than I thought it was when I was reading it alone. So we continue in the book of Deuteronomy, the Gilbert House Fellowship, posted Sunday mornings to gilberthouse.org. And let's see, next Tuesday night, who's coming up? Just a note, Skywatch TV, by the way, no program on the 22nd, Tuesday the 22nd, because the Christian Television Network has its annual or semi-annual fundraising drive, which runs all week. So we're being preempted the week of the 22nd. We'll pick up again with another discussion with Carl Gallops on September 29th, talking about his best-selling book, The Rabbi Who Found Messiah. And that is, let's see, Tuesday evenings at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 8:30 Central Time on the Christian Television Network. But again, no program on the 22nd of September. 29th of September, we return with Carl Gallops. Thank you for listening to A View from the Bunker. We appreciate your review and your like at iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, or wherever else you find us. You'll see the links at vftb.net. And A View from the Bunker, we remind you, is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.